Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
Well, good evening to you, and thank you so much for being here this evening. And we hope to open God's Word this evening and glean some knowledge from it as we can do every single time we open the Word and every single time we're here at worship. We're going to be talking tonight about lessons from Eli, and I invite you to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 2 in your Bibles, and we'll be camping out there for the remainder of the lesson, 1 Samuel chapter 2, and we'll be looking at that. I hope we conveyed our excitement this morning with our big announcement. And we have been planning that as ministers. We've been planning that for months now, and it is going to be a fantastic event. And I've had so many people say that we're excited about what's going to be happening next year, and we are too. We're barely able to contain ourselves with what it is going to accomplish next year, we feel, and it is going to be wonderful to have you involved with that. We usually do the ministers, Andrew usually has the ministers speak on the last Sunday evening of the month, but this month is special, obviously, because of our giveaway day and of our special trunk or treat that was mentioned before. So that's why I am here this night tonight. So let's get started as we talk about Eli tonight. Eli, like most other Bible characters, is truly fascinating. I firmly believe that God has a reason for every word, every story, every person that He put in the Bible. And Eli is no exception. Just like every person can teach us something in the Bible, I believe Eli can teach us a lot. And that's from a positive and a negative side. Romans 15:4 says, "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, that through perseverance and encouragement in the Scriptures that we might have hope." I've talked a lot before in previous lessons, maybe I've even alluded to it, about Steve Jobs. And I make no secret that I'm a big Apple person. I love Apple products. I love the company, the way that they do business, the way that they design things, the way that they conduct themselves and market themselves. And Steve Jobs is mainly behind a lot of their success. He passed away just a few years ago, but his presence can still be felt. He was the CEO of Apple Computer from its inception in 1976, and he was ousted by the board of directors in 1985. He served as the CEO of the company again many years later in 1997 after the computer company got bought that he had formed while he was gone from Apple in exile. And what Jobs did with Apple when he came back in 1997 was absolutely extraordinary. Apple was in shambles. Stocks were at an all-time low. Investors viewed the company as a joke. Microsoft was eating Apple's lunch. And sales were low, they were flat, there was lackluster, they had no staying power. The company was divided into lots of subgroups with all these different agendas. You had a bunch of infighting, all these different things. And Jobs came back and he wiped the slate clean. He discontinued over 80% of the products that Apple was currently making at the time. He simplified and solidified roles within the company. He carved out a new direction for a company that had basically seemed directionless in the last decade or so of its life. In mid-1997, it was said that Apple Computer only had enough cash to last another 3 months before they was going to have to declare bankruptcy. 18 months after his arrival, Apple introduced a new line of colored computers called the iMac. No one had ever put color in a computer before. They had never done that before. And they did it, and it was a very successful product. 18 months after that, he released a product in 2001 that put Apple back on the map and basically rebranded them as a consumer electronics company. And this product set the tone, and it continues still to set the tone for today. It was a little device called the iPod. The iPod sold millions and millions. It changed the way we listen to music. It changed the way we buy music. And it led to other devices that you have with you right now, probably iPhones and iPads. But Jobs was mainly responsible for Apple's resurrection. He took the company from broke to more valuable than ExxonMobil in almost just 9 to 10 years. That's pretty amazing. He had an incredible design sense. He had hard work. He had determination. He had a business acumen that fueled the next generation for the company that he started. Now, all of that I just said, all of that's public knowledge. All of that kind of stuff is the stuff that we have seen, the different things that we could watch and see what he did. But what we don't know is how he was as a person. Some people have alluded to this in certain biographies and said that Jobs was extremely eccentric and volatile. He was known privately for his outbursts and his harsh language to his employees. He had a hard and uncompromising manner that was just flat rude some of the times. And his personal history was really no better. He fathered a child in an illegitimate relationship when he was young, and he denied that for many years. Steve Jobs may have been a visionary whose influence can still be felt, but the image that we may have seen is not the image of the man that actually was. And I say all that to say that there are two sides to every story. I tell this story because we're going to look at two different sides of Eli tonight. Eli had his triumphs and he loved God, but he also had his mistakes. And his mistakes, with his sons in particular, is what he will be remembered by. So tonight I invite you, like I said before, to turn to 1 Samuel chapter 2, and we're going to figure out what we can learn from Eli. Just to give you a little background on Eli to start off with. There are so many characters who appear in the pages of the Bible that we know very little about. Like I said before, I think we can profit from both positives and negatives of studying some of these characters, and I think Eli is no exception. Eli, just to give you a little bit of background, was the next to last judge of Israel. He followed Samson as judge over Israel, and he was confronted with the same Philistine oppression which Samson had faced. In addition to becoming a judge, Eli was also the high priest over Israel. He was the first to hold both of these offices at the same time. Because of these positions that he held, he was a very influential person, had a lot of power. That being said, he was not without fault. In our lives, sitting in this auditorium, there may be people that are in positions of influence. But that does not mean that we can be above reproach. We might be managers at our jobs. We might own our own businesses. We might be deacons here at Graymere or ministers or elders. But that does not mean that we're right all the time. Only working with the ministers and the elders for the last few months and some of the deacons for the last few months, I can tell you that none of those men would say, I'm above reproach, I'm right all the time. That doesn't mean, though, just because we're ministers or we're elders or we're deacons that we don't have problems. That doesn't mean that we don't face situations that we make mistakes, that we make the wrong choices, that we don't have problems of our own. We have temptations, that we have mistakes, and ministers, elders, deacons, we're not without fault either. But I want to talk about Eli's conduct towards his sons. And what are we going to talk about when we talk about Eli's conduct towards his sons? If we want to zero in on chapter 2, verses 12 through 17, we're going to read that in just a moment. But I want to put the next picture slide up here, and I know y'all will love this. I have two amazing little boys, and y'all know and love them. And y'all have brought them into this family, and you have made them one of their own. But I often think and find myself wondering, how am I going to raise them? Not necessarily how I'm raising them now, not necessarily what I'm doing, but how am I going to raise them down the road? What am I going to do with raising them down the road? Obviously, my wonderful and beautiful wife will work with me together on this. But I can't help but wonder if I'm going to do the right things. am I going to raise them correctly? Those of you who have raised children, you can look back and say and see the mistakes that you may have made. Being a parent is the scariest thing that I have ever done. I really thought that joining the Marine Corps and doing the Marine Corps would be the scariest, most challenging thing that I've ever done. I thought my rest of my life would be downhill from that. Boy, was I wrong. Being a parent is the scariest thing that I've ever done. And I've often thought about, I might not have been so eager to sign up for the job had I known that it would have been this scary. Some would argue that disciplining a child isn't showing them love. I completely disagree with that. As I was a youth minister and now an education minister, I saw that a lot, and I saw that attitude a lot of the time, and I saw the attitude of my children can do no wrong a lot. And I saw that. I don't want to be like that. I don't want to ever think that my children can do no wrong. So I can sympathize with Eli in his conduct towards his sons. Let's read what 1 Samuel has to say about Eli's sons. Verse 12 of chapter 2. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. Verse 13, the customs of the priests with the people were that when any man offered a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling and the three-pronged fork in his hand, and he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. This is what they did at Shiloh and to all the Israelites who came there. Moreover, before the fat was burned, the priest's servant would offer the man to say, who was sacrificing, give meat to the priest to roast, for he will not accept boiled meat from you, but only raw. Verse 16. And if the man said to him, let them burn the fat first, then they take as much as you wish, he would say, no, you must give it now. And if not, I will take it by force. Thus the sin of the young men was very great in the sight of the Lord, for the men treated the offering of the Lord with contempt. One of the most notable things here recorded in connection with Eli is reference to his two sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They were priests. These two men served as priests. And it says here in verse 12, they were worthless men. When they offered sacrifices to God, rather than taking the authorized share here, they took as much as they wanted. Verses 13 and 14 tell us that. And in addition to that, they took the portion before the fat had been burnt as a sweet odor to God. So consequently, the people despised the offerings that these men had made. Let's go ahead and read on here in the next few verses, verses 22 through 25 of chapter 2. This is where Eli comes into the story here. Now Eli was very old, and he kept hearing all that his sons were doing to all Israel, and how they lay with women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of meeting. And he said to them, why do you do such things? For I hear your evil dealings from all the people. No, my sons, it is of no good report that I hear the people of the Lord spreading abroad. If someone sins against a man, God will mediate for him. But if he sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him? But they would not listen to the voice of their father, for it was the will of the Lord to put them to death. These two sons also committed fornication with the women who were assigned to serve in the temple, according to verse 22. Eli, it says right here, we can read it, he was very much aware of his son's sins. This is not like it was a secret. It's not like he didn't know. He was very much aware of his son's sins. Everyone was very much aware of his son's sins. The report of their conduct circulated among the people, and Eli here administers a mild rebuke to his children and tries to persuade them not to sin before God. Apparently it wasn't enough because they did not listen. Eli was in a position here where he was the high priest and the judge over Israel. He was in a position of authority. He was responsible for the worship which was offered to God. He was responsible for that. He should have dismissed his own sons, but he continued to let them serve. Eli obviously didn't make the hard decision. We see what decision he should have made, but he didn't make that hard decision. Hard decisions are part of being a Christian. Difficulty, I think, brings us closer to Christ. And I'd like to expand on that by saying making difficult decisions brings us closer to Christ. God looked down on this sorry scene, basically, and He sent a man of God to Eli. He told Eli that He had honored his sons above God, as we go back down in verse 29, because He did not rebuke them. Eli was in a position to remove his sons from serving as priests because they committed a sin, but he would not stand up against them. He did not do this. He lacked the righteous indignation. And we're going to talk about that term here in a minute. He lacked the righteous indignation that Jesus really manifested when He was cleansed the temple in John chapter 2. If you remember, Jesus made a whip of cords in that chapter and drove the money changers out of the temple. He was standing up against an injustice. He stood up against what He felt was blatantly wrong. Writer A.C. Grant had said this about Eli. He says, "The character of Eli, while sincere and devout, seems to have been entirely lacking in firmness. He appears in the history to have been a good man, full of humility and gentleness, but weak and indulgent. He is not a strong personality. He is always overshadowed by some more commanding or interesting figure." You think about those terms right there. Lacking in firmness. Good man, but weak and indulgent. What if somebody said that about you? What if somebody said that about your spouse, about your father or about your mother, about one of the elders here, the deacons or the ministers? What if somebody said and used those terms to describe any of those people? I'm afraid that many of us are going to be guilty sometimes, as Eli was, of lacking the moral fiber sometimes to withstand sin. There are similar areas of our life, and I've got three of these right here, similar areas of our life that we're going to maybe lack in those when we commit sin. One is this lacking righteous indignation. Righteous indignation, that's basically a term that means standing up and against an injustice. Standing up against what we know is right. Like Eli, one writer put it, we as Christians have sometimes become gutless with rubber backbones. We'd rather bend to accept any doctrinal departure from the truth rather than to fight it. Truth that is important to stand up for. Because if there is no truth, there is no God. Today we are absolutely inundated by the media and the other things, and get us to try to believe this idea of, you know, whatever you believe is okay, whatever you believe is okay, and we're all okay and everything is okay, and let's just live in harmony and peace and rainbows and teddy bears and all these other different things, right? Everything will be fine. Some people use the word tolerance to describe that. But tolerance only goes so far. And apparently in this day and age it goes to talk about the people who feel mistreated or bullied. Even though the Bible is very blatantly against this kind of lifestyle, against these different things like this, this is branded persecution. Tolerance, last time I checked, was not just a one-way street. I think we need to wake up to the fact that we are becoming more and more susceptible to this peace at any price kind of approach towards doctrine, towards teaching, towards biblically sound teaching. Sometimes we lack the backbone to withstand the advances of sin, and we just give in to the world and what it wants us to believe. The second place there, number B, we honor our children above the Lord sometimes. Eli also sinned because he did not remove his sons as priests from God. He honored them above God. In a similar fashion, sometimes we as parents honor their children above the Lord. This is hard. This is difficult because I love my children more than just about anything. But the Lord should take the highest place. As a relatively new parent, this idea is frankly hard for me to grasp. In the third place, see there, we fail to restrain our children. Some of us are tainted with this philosophy of modern psychiatry, which teaches that children should not be restrained lest they would grow up inhibited somehow. I have the honor of going at many different places and teaching my digital parenting curriculum, talking about digital devices and the internet safety and different things like that. A class, actually, which started here at Graymere over 2 years ago, I'm proud to say. But when I see these problems, when these parents come up to me, when I see these problems, the problem is not the internet. The problem is not the device. The problem is not the computer or any of that kind of stuff. It's the parent and the parents that manage them. Children need restraint from their parents. They need rules. They need to be corrected, and they need to know what's right and what's wrong, or else they'll grow up respecting neither. Eli obviously had this problem with his children. We can learn from that. We've all heard the joke when a parent says, "Well, this is going to hurt me a lot more than it hurts you." But it's so true. Because it is going to hurt us more than it's going to hurt them. It is going to cause us more pain than it is going to hurt them. Disciplining our children is more painful to us than it is them, and that's why I think that sometimes we just don't do it. We cannot be afraid to correct and discipline our children. We can't be afraid to correct and discipline our brothers and sisters. Mistakes when children are young are made are easy to overcome than mistakes when they're older. We were just coming out of the Camp Meribah on Saturday after our elders and ministers retreat, and I was thinking of this sermon. They have a huge banner over the thing. When you go out of the gate, it says, "Building boys is better than mending men." Something to think about, because we are so much laying that foundation for children when they're young. Next, we'll talk about God's judgment against Eli's house. God had a judgment here, and because of Eli's sins, with reference to his sons, God brought a judgment against Eli and his house. He was sent a man of God, like we said before. He was sent a man of God to foretell God's judgment. And he was foretold these things. Number one, he was foretold that the descendants of Eli would die at an early age, that Hophni and Phinehas would die the same day. Number three, that another family of Aaron would be given the office of high priest. Shortly thereafter all this, the word of the Lord came to Samuel in the night. And this revelation from God stated that virtually the same thing. God's judgment is against the house of Eli. And the next morning, Eli demanded that Samuel tell him the message from the Lord. This is found in 1 Samuel chapter 3, verse 17. He demanded this. It's interesting to note here that Eli's burning desire to know the will of God. That's a positive thing that we can emulate from his burning desire to know what God would expect of him, what God would want of him. And when Samuel related this word of the Lord to Eli, the aged high priest said, "It is the Lord, let him do what seems good to him." 1 Samuel 3:18. Eli's submission to the will of the Lord really reminds me of the prayer that Jesus prayed in the Garden of Gethsemane. He prayed this. He said, "Let this cup pass from me, yet not as I will, but as you will." Matthew 26, verse 39. I think that's an incredibly important question to think about when we're thinking about what we want versus what God wants. Your will be done. Can we really say that? Can we really say that and say, "God, your will be done"? Your will be done means putting aside all of our wants. It means submitting to something that we're not in control of. And boy, do we love our control. We love to say, "I'm in control of my life. I decide my destiny. I decide these different things." But when as Christians, actually the opposite is true. Eli, we can learn from him, quietly submitted to the will and control of the Lord. He was not like a lot of others who became bitter and would complain about the straws that they drew in life. Instead, Eli submitted to the Lord's will even though he didn't like it. And lastly, I wanted to end on a positive note, a somewhat positive note, talk about Eli's love for the Lord. Sometime after this prophecy, the Israelites engaged the Philistines in battle. And this story doesn't end like you think it would, but we can still glean some positive things from it. At the first encounter, 4,000 Israelites died on the battlefield. This is in 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 2. And in desperation, the people had Hophni and Phinehas. They had them bring the Ark of the Covenant They had them bring the Ark of the Covenant to lead the children of Israel into battle, and it didn't really go so well. The next battle, the children of Israel lost 30,000 Israelites in that battle. They would die in one day, and the Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines. It was not a good day for Israel. And what follows is a pretty sad story, but we can still get some positives from it. Eli's true love for the Lord shines here. It may have been a little or too late, but it still was there. Think about this scene in your head for a second in 1 Samuel chapter 4, verse 13. Eli is sitting by the tent, the gate at the tent of meeting, and he's awaiting this news for the battle, and it says his heart trembled for the ark of God. And then finally a messenger came and reported the news of the battle, and when Samuel had heard that the ark of the Lord was captured, he fell over backward, and this is tragic, he fell over backward, broke his neck, and died. The scriptures specifically state that Eli did not die when he heard that his sons had been killed, or the defeat of Israel, but rather he died when he learned that the ark of the covenant had been taken. The ark of the covenant, of course, at this time held the very presence of God. Perhaps he had learned to honor God and his sons. Maybe it was too late, but perhaps he'd learned that at this time. Eli's concern for the ark manifests his love for the Lord. And too many of us today, I think, fail to manifest that kind of concern over matters pertaining to the Lord and His church. Just like we talked about this morning in our big presentation about the push that we're going to make next year, we are in the soul-winning business. And it is the most important job that we have. I used to tell the kids in high school classes, when I used to teach high school classes regularly, I used to tell them that we are Christ's representatives to the world. We are billboards for Christ. We're sometimes the only gospel that people will see. How we act and what we say, how we conduct ourselves in stressful situations, all of these different things. And we forget that we have the most important job of all, and that is telling people about Christ. I think one of the many lessons that we can learn from Eli tonight is just sincerity. We need some of Eli's sincerity. We need men and women who love the Lord enough to prepare themselves to serve in His church. We need men and women who are concerned for the lost and willing to work to lead them to salvation. We need men and women like Eli who truly love the Lord. So, kind of concluding and wrapping up this evening, as you can see, there's a lot we can learn from just a relatively what we might consider a minor character in the Bible. We can learn a lot from Eli. We can learn a lot from his mistakes, and we can learn a lot from his positive attributes. We will be tested, just like Eli. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. We will be forced to make very important and hard choices like Eli, whether or not to stand up to sin in our lives or ignore it. It may not be something as ominous, as conflicting and restraining as our children. It may not be taking a job that takes us away from worship services. It may be ending a friendship that's been corrosive to our Christianity. We may have some hard decisions to make to stay faithful to God, but we can learn from Eli in that respect. So tonight, I invite you to take a stand against sin. I invite you to stand up to sin in your life. I invite you to change whatever it is that you need to change in your life. Tonight, if you have any spiritual needs, we can pray for you. If you'd like to become a Christian, be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins, to say that I believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, you can do that this evening. Let's stand up to sin tonight. Let's do that while we come and forward and stand and sing.